All right, Proverbs 30. 30 verse 17. Let's start there today, shall we? And then we're going to learn how to get married today in Genesis. 20. Why 20? I don't know. Another day. In preview of Esau and what's to come, maybe this will be a good one. This guy's Proverbs verse 30, not a good proverb. Somebody read that. What did I say? 30:17. Stop with the 20s, Jared. You're killing me. You implanted it in my head. Who's hungry? The eye that mocks a father and scorns a mother. Okay, what do you call that? What is the eye that mocks a father and scorns a mother? What quality are we talking about here? Disobedience, or the inability to submit to authority. Okay, our pastor back home in Texas tells a story. He was the chaplain of Louisville High School football before he went into the school. He was going to be a coach, and then God called him to the pastorate, and then he thought he was going to, a couple years in the pastorate, was like, I'm quitting, going back to coaching, this is too hard. But for a season of his life, he was the head chaplain of Louisville High School football team, okay? Now, you need to understand a little about high school football in Texas, okay? It goes God, football, and that can be debated, okay, as to which one comes first, family, and then everything else. It is cultish where I come from, okay? It is weird. You guys remember the movie Friday Night Lights? Friday Night Lights is about Odessa Permian football. That's West Texas. They're slightly more crazy about football than where I come from, but my high school regularly played Odessa Permian when we grew up, okay? So it's a whole different level, okay? This kid, one of the kids on this team that my pastor had the opportunity to observe, was one of only three-time All-Americans in the history of the state of Texas at this point. Now, this is back in the it's late 70s, early 80s, okay? So this guy was of the likes of, you guys remember the name Eric Dickerson? Eric Dickerson was a three-time All-American. For all you ladies, you're like, what? This guy was really, really, really good. I mean, incredible, right? He's a running back. He was so good that literally he had his choice of schools. It was like, where do you want to go? Wherever you go, you're getting a full ride. So he decided he was going to come to USC, okay? And he was going to replace at the time a guy by the name of Ricky Bell, okay, who was the runner-up for the Heisman way back, I think, in the early 80s. Really good player. And this guy was going to be groomed to be Ricky Bell's replacement at the University of Southern California, right? So that was his meal ticket. So our pastor is this guy's heading out, and season's over, says, hey, do you think this kid will be the next Heisman Trophy winner? Because he was that good, right? And the high school football coach said he will never touch the ball. He will never play a down of football at USC. And our pastor said, really? Like, why is that? This coach, over, you know, 3 or 4 years now working with this kid, saw a quality in this kid that he knew would be a death sentence to him. It would be doom. So sure enough, this kid goes out to USC. He plays for a little bit, never touches the ball, and he quits. Comes back to Texas, goes to Kilgore Junior College, right, which is in the middle of nowhere. If you're from Texas, you may have heard of it. Out past Tyler, Texas. Leads a rebellion. No, sorry. Gets kicked off that team because he chased a kid with a shotgun. Okay, so he gets kicked off that team. Goes to like East Texas State, I think it was at the time. Leads a rebellion against the coach. Gets kicked off that team. The guy's so good that SMU decides, we'll give you a tryout. So he plays for SMU for a while and quits that as well. So he gets kicked off two different teams. He quits two different teams. He was so naturally gifted that the Dallas Cowboys gave him like a walk-on tryout. Didn't make the team. But that's the kind of talent this kid had, okay? Our pastor had heard from him, the guy's living in like a common law marriage out in the middle of nowhere, trying to sue his current employer because they over some whatever, like just so he could get money. The quality that coach at Louisville High School saw in that kid was this one. He could not submit to authority, and it was the doom of him, right? This kid had more natural talent than 99.9% of the world in terms of his football gifting. Could have been a great player, would have taken him, you know, eons in life. At least he would have gotten a free education at a pretty decent college out of it, but he could not submit to authority. What is the end result, by the way, of a kid or an individual that does not have the ability to submit to authority? What does part B there say? That's what you did to an executed criminal in Israel. You threw them in the valley of Gehenna, and you let the ravens pick at their body. Like, that is what someone who can't submit to authority, they're as good as a dead, rotting, raven-picked carcass. Like, ugh, right? That's no bueno, okay? I don't know how you guys do in this area. I don't know what your tendencies may be in terms of authority over you. But thanks to Satan and Eve and the fallout from that, none of us tend to do real well with the natural desire and inclination to joyfully submit to the authority above us, right? Some of us have wonderful authority above us that is godly, that we respect, that we care about or whatever, and it makes it a little bit easier to submit until that your authority does something that you don't think they should have done or what have you. So some of us are on that end of the spectrum where it's easier. And others of you, as we've talked about before, work for non-Christians, have bosses that you don't respect, you question their decision-making, you question their integrity, and it makes it really, really hard, right? Regardless of situations that we're in, that quality needs to be one that is in all of us, okay? And obviously, as we've talked about before, there's a line somewhere where if you can no longer submit to the authority because of moral purposes or whatever, then, you know, you need to step away from that situation. But all of us are there. And all of us need to be young men and women that can do these things, or we will not end up far in life, or we'll end up like this kid did in the scriptures, or this kid that we talked about this morning who ended up being in a trailer park in the middle of Texas somewhere trying to sue his employer because he's good for nothing, and that was the end of his life. So something to ponder and consider. By the way, what happens, fellas, if you grow up with the inability to submit to authority? What happens when God grants you authority as a husband and as a father? How do you think you handle that authority? You either abuse it, right, which means you're a dictator. Ladies, how many of you want to live in a home with a dictator that says jump and you say how high? That doesn't sound like a lot of fun, right? What's the other extreme? Passive. You're just passive, right? You sit on the lazy boy with the remote and wife makes all the decisions because you've never really had to deal with authority, so you don't know how to handle it, right? So those are the two extremes. Not fun to be underneath that type of authority. So if you ever hope, guys, to handle authority properly, we have to first learn to submit to it before we're ever going to be able to handle it in a way that is godly and honoring to our wives and honoring to our kids. So something to noodle on, okay? So especially for guys, okay? Ladies have a tough challenge and that they have to be in a situation both underneath their fathers and then ultimately underneath the marriage structure to submit to that authority, which is tough, okay? So guys, do all of these ladies a favor and let's handle that authority that's been granted by God to us with respect and with diligence. And that starts by how you submit to authority now and how you'll handle authority later, okay? So thoughts or questions on this? This is, by the way, that is part of my bent. I struggle with this, right? My persister, black-white worldview, right, wrong. You're either on my side of the fence or the other side of the fence. There is no gray. Boy, I'm great when everybody's on my side of the fence. But when I have to debate things that I am passionate about and really care about with folks that have a different perspective that isn't right or wrong, it's just different. It is really hard for me at times to submit when it's just not the issue that I want. So that is, especially for persisters, you will find yourselves in that camp and just know that you're bent. So, yeah, thoughts? Am I the only person in the room that struggles with submission to authority? Good. These are all for me anyway, so. What's that? Perfect. All right. Well, tuck that one away. An hour later, you'll need it eventually. So, all right, to Genesis, shall we? Let me pray for us. We will dive into Genesis chapter 24. This is a cool chapter, very different feel than maybe the rest of the journey thus far, at least on the application side of things for us. But we will now watch the heart of Abraham to get a wife for his son Isaac, and we will see how that plays out. So we're going to get a whole lot of text on this. So let me pray for us, and then we'll dive in. God, thanks for another morning to wake up, to hopefully see your sunrise, and to enjoy the blessings of a new morning. God, thanks for the weather and just the opportunity to be in a place like this, to have the freedom to open your Bible without fear of consequence, without fear of our lives, that we, God, can hold a Bible in our hands to see your spoken word, your written word to us that speaks to us now even today. God, would you do a work in our lives this morning? Would you help us to walk away from our time changed, to be more like your son? And would you use these moments, God, just to make us more like Christ? That is our hope and our prayer. So God, as we study Abraham in his last days and see, God, what he is concerned about, would you incline our hearts just to see these things and to draw closer to you? We love you. In Christ's name, amen. All right, so big picture, we are at the end of Abraham's life, right? We have seen eight or so tests in his life. We saw the culmination of his entire life's work in Genesis chapter 22 is Abraham is called to lay Isaac on the altar. He is willing to do that. We see the culmination of that faith and that trust in God. So we finished there last week. In chapter 23, we saw Sarah die at the ripe old age of 137. So she is gone. And now Abraham is beginning to think, not beginning to, but continue to think, I guess, about the future, right? So we've got a guy that's going to be the father of a nation. We've got one kid, but we don't have a wife. So that, in his life, is his chief concern, okay? So chapter 24 is all about, man, how is Abraham going to do this, right? So we're finding out that Isaac at this point is 40, okay? Abraham's going to die at 175 years old. Here in the end of chapter 25, he'll die, okay? But at this point in his life, we've got a son with no wife, and that is his chief concern at this point. So let's pick up chapter 24, verse 1, and let's see how Abraham handles this.
Now Abraham was old and well advanced in years, and the Lord had blessed Abraham in all things.
Okay, what does that mean, God's blessed him in all things? How's he doing at the end of his life? He's loaded. Okay, what's the tendency, you know, for guys at the end of their life when they got a ton of money? What do? No responsibilities. Yeah, keep it, check out, you know, buy a Porsche, unbutton your shirt, have a midlife crisis, right? Drive your convertible, get a big fat gold chain, right? I don't know. His wife's dead. So, you know, woohoo, I'm single. You know, that's not Abraham, right? Not that he can drive a Porsche, but you see his mind and everything about him is focused on what's coming next. His money is not for him. He's making sure he's setting himself up and his lineage up for success. So God has blessed him. However, verse 2, this is his concern. And I want you to notice the language is really strong, how concerned Abraham is about this, this situation of his son not having a wife. In fact, we'll probably need a guy to read that. Dave, pick up there in verse 2. All right, so he says to his servant, verse 2, his oldest of his household, who would you guys guess this is? What servant is this? Who?
Steward.
Yeah, what's his name? Do you remember? This is Eleazar, okay? Now, there's a lot going on in the story, and I found it fascinating as I was reading it this morning. You've got Abraham, you've got Isaac, we're going to see Rebecca here in a little bit. I've never noticed the role that Eleazar plays, right? Well, in this culture, had Abraham not had a son, who is now the son? Eleazar, right? So here is a guy that's incredibly humble. He's going to have to go serve this, you know, I say snotty-nosed kid, you know, Isaac's not, but he's the younger guy that basically took his own blessing. So in that culture, Eleazar would have been the guy that received the double portion. He would have been the firstborn, and now Abraham is commanding him to go find a wife for the guy that just replaced you and took all your money, okay? And you're going to see Eleazar is, He's amazing. Humble, concerned about God, concerned about Abraham, wants to honor his master, wants to honor his master's son. He's a good dude. You see why this guy, and we don't know for sure that it's Eleazar, but given the rest of the text, more than likely. So Abraham is saying, who do I trust more than anyone on earth to go find a wife for my son, my chief servant in my household? Okay, so Eleazar is a neat guy. I have a lot of respect for him. Okay, now notice the language. Place your hand under my thigh, and you swear by God that you will not go get a wife for my son Isaac here in Canaan, but you go home, okay? He is saying exactly what you think he's saying, okay? We are talking about reproduction. We are talking about the seed of the next generation, and he says, you put your hand under my thigh, and you swear to me by my procreative organ that you are going to get the right type of wife for my kid, okay? So we don't make thigh covenants anymore, thank goodness. But that you see the seriousness in this tone, right? Like, my line is dependent upon how you handle this situation, okay? And what is his chief concern? Not just that he needs a wife, which is obvious, but what type of wife is Abraham concerned about? Yeah, what does that mean from the Canaanites versus home? What picture do you see in your head? Who lives in Canaan? Coastal plains, who lives there? Philistines, guys, remember this, right? So what type of people are they? God-fearing? No. Okay, so Abraham says, do not go to the non-God-fearing people that, by the way, are just a hop, skip, and a jump to the west, northwest, and get a wife. That would have been the easy thing to do. Instead, I want you to take a 500-mile journey back to Ur of the Chaldees, where my family is from, to go find a godly wife, which is fascinating because when he gets there, there are people in Ur that fear God. So talk to me about the influence of Abraham. Is that not crazy? You're going to see when they come into town that the people that he meets talk about the Lord. They know him. They worship him. And Abraham knows this. So he says, you go home. Okay? So just, again, want you to see this. Ladies, by the way, who is in charge of finding the wife for Isaac? The dad. Okay, I kind of like that, right? So I remind my girls of that frequently. My oldest daughter signed a marriage contract when she was like 5. And she wrote it down, and it says something to the effect of, I agree to let my daddy choose my husband, and we signed it, and yeah, so it's all good. I still have that. So that's a very safe place. So, and I remind her of that frequently. Nope, that is my job, and you signed it. So you relinquished your rights until you were 35, so my job. So the rest of the girls in our family won't sign it for some reason. So she's now talked them out of it. But the first one I get. Okay, so that's the idea. So go back to Canaan, go back to Ur, not in Canaan, and go find a wife for Isaac, okay? Now, I want you to notice Eleazar's response here, verse 5. So what is the plan here with said woman? Eleazar is going to roll into town and say what? Yeah, master's son needs a wife, and you're going to do what? You're going to come with me. To where? Where is that? Who are you? Where am I going? All my family's here? No. You can go get Isaac, and you can bring your sorry tale back here, and we can live in my hometown, right? I mean, you can see like, so what type of woman, I mean, just from the get-go, what type of gal is this going to have to be? Submissive. But at this point, like, she's not called to submit to Isaac yet, okay? What is she going to need to be? Submissive to God? She's going to have to be able to see that that's God's will in her life. She's going to have to be a wee bit crazy. Let's do this, right? That's an adventure. If that's what God's calling me to do, 500 miles away, I mean, this is a gal that's got to have a pretty high bar. Yeah, Pete.
Wouldn't Isaac, like, have money?
Yep.
You know, so if he rose up in the town.
Yeah.
Hey,
yeah.
I need a wife.
Yeah, but Isaac's not going. Isaac doesn't get to come. It's just Eleazar. Now, Eleazar will demonstrate that he's got money. So that will be clear so that they know, dude, you're not some guy that just rolled into town and, right, are looking for a place to stay and talk a big game. No, so he'll demonstrate that, yeah, my master's filthy loaded, okay? But she doesn't get to see Isaac. She doesn't meet him. Doesn't know anything about. I mean, so you see this bar. So, ladies, I want you to see that. Guys, I want you to see that. This is a high bar. We're looking for a godly, adventurous, trusting gal that is willing to do what God calls her to do, even though that may be crazy. Okay? I mean, there's probably very few people back home that are this type of gal. Okay? And Eliezer, Abraham, does not apologize. So Eliezer says, hey, can I bring Isaac back at least to meet her? Or can we go live there? Like, what do you think? So, and Abraham is like, this is beat his fist on the table type deal right here. Verse 6, this is Abraham's response.
Abraham said to him, see to it that you do not take my son back there. The Lord, the God of heaven, who took me from my father's house and from the land of my kindred, and who spoke to me before him. To your offspring I will give this land. He will send his angel before you, and you shall take a wife for my son from there.
All right, do not take Isaac back there, meaning his home is here, because God has promised that my home will be here, so Isaac ain't leaving. She's leaving. Or verse 8, if the woman is not willing to follow you, then you will be free from this oath, only do not take my son back there. If she won't go, you don't have to bring a wife home, okay? So, but we're going to find a godly woman who's willing to do this. What do you see in Abraham's faith at this point in his life? Man, he is not going to compromise at all. God, you're going to have to do this. I don't know how. I don't know who it is. You know, he didn't ring, you know, Laban up and, you know, and say, hey, we're coming and I need your sister. And he's trusting that God's going to figure this out. So you see a man that is content. He's settled. He's seen God do the miraculous. So he's like, you know what? It will happen. So do not take Isaac back there. And if this woman won't come, then you are free from my oath. Okay? Verse 9, they make this covenant. They confirm that this is how it's going to go down. Verse 10, the servant then took 10 camels, okay, from his master, set out with a variety of good things. So Pete, there you go, from his master's hand, and they arose and went to Mesopotamia, the city of Nahor. So this is where, this is this is Sumer. He goes back home. So they take this very long journey. They would have had to go up north, just like Rick showed you, and then back down south through the Fertile Crescent back to Ur. So long, arduous, very purposeful, okay? Now, as he's rolling into the city, Eleazar with his entourage in verse 11, this is what he does. All right, so he's got a slew of camels with him, right? And he's going to have them stop outside. Where's he headed to, verse 11?
The well.
Why would he be going to the well? Because he's been on a long journey, needs water, camels need water, he's tired, okay? And now he's going to pray, verse 12. All right, give me some observations just about Eleazar for a second. What do you notice about just the character of this guy? Absolutely. This guy's 500 miles away. There ain't nobody around. There's nobody making a punch a time card or overseeing his work. This guy is a faithful servant, right? I like him, okay? He wants to make sure that Abraham is blessed. Okay, so you can see, you can infer how Abraham must have treated this guy and what their relationship must have been like. He is very, very cherished in his household. Okay, what do you notice about his prayer? What is he looking for? What does he say, ladies? Make some observations for me. What type of gal is he looking for? Generous, absolutely, right? With her time. Who is Eleazar to said gal at the well, whoever this person's going to be? Nobody. I don't know who you are. Dude, you're a filthy, desert-traveling, smelly dude that I don't know with a lot of baggage called camels with you, okay? So what is he asking? Keep looking to the text. Yeah, for sure, okay? What does he specifically ask this guy will do? give him water and my camels, okay? So this is a big deal. Now, I have some stats that camels can drink 25 gallons of water at a time, okay, in one sitting, 25 gallons, okay? More than likely, Rebecca would have been carrying a 3-gallon bucket of water, okay? So think about that. So she's got to go to the well, drop it in, right? I don't know if you guys have seen this. Bucket hits the water, however deep that is, and then you got to pull 3 gallons out, right? How are her shoulders feeling about right now? This is a strong girl, okay? He's got a drink, right? So he's not putting down 25 gallons, but he probably has multiple camels, right? So this is a long process. This is a painstaking process. This is a physically exerting process. And she has to do it with, there's zero in it for her. She's just being hospitable. She's just being the right type of gal and saying, listen, yeah, you're a stranger. You have need. This is my home. I'm going to take care of you and your whole flock. That is the type of gal that Eliezer says, I want that type of gal. Okay, so ladies, as you think through the lens of dating, relationships, qualities of a woman, what type of, and again, this chapter wasn't written so we'd figure out who to date and how to date, but I think there's some great implications in here of that. What are you seeing? What type of qualities need to be present in a gal?
Selfless.
Absolutely, right? That's impressive. Selfless, okay? What else? Yep. What does she look like? Do we know? Does it matter? We're going to see a comment on her morality here in a second, but I want you to see where it fits in the order of operations. What does Abraham ask for? Does he care what she looks like? Does he care about her past? There's some fascinating things that you can just draw from this. So we see a gal that's going to have to raise herself above and beyond the gals around her. She is a servant. She is selfless. She's all the things that you guys mentioned, okay? And that is what this guy's looking for, okay? So as he is praying, this is phenomenal, right? As he is praying, verse 15, it came about before he had finished speaking that, behold, Rebekah, who was born to Bethuel, the son of Milcah, the wife of Abraham's brother Nahor, came out with a jar on her shoulder. So she is out there with the rest of these women that would have come at evening time when it was cooler to draw water for their families, to bring it back home, to make sure that, you know, their family was taken care of, okay? The girl, 16, was very beautiful, a virgin, and no man had relations with her, and she went down to the spring and filled her jar and came up. So she's there, she's getting water for her family, and we see some observations about this gal, but I want you to notice where they fit in order of operations. We find out that she is indeed beautiful, right? And she's a virgin. So we learn about her morality, okay? But before all those things, this is icing, okay? She's beautiful, great. So was Sarah, okay? Not requirement. She's also a virgin, right? So great, but we don't even see that requirement mentioned previous. Now, it tells you a lot about what this type of gal, about her character, about what she's done, about the type of home that she's been raised in, especially in a city that was idol worshiping and probably had a lot looser morality than maybe her family did. She's a gal that says, no, I'm gonna save myself, okay? Now, let me step back just for a second and just make some assumptions here. I would guess in a room like this, okay, full of singles, that quality is probably not true of all of you. It certainly was not true of me when I walked into marriage, okay? Both my wife and I, before we came into marriage, had pasts, okay? I lived 18 years as a pagan, okay? Came to college and then came to know the Lord through college, and I made a ton of decisions that if I could hit the reset button on, boy, I would go back in a heartbeat, okay? My wife has a similar journey, okay? We have a phenomenal marriage. Neither one of us have that gift. We are desperately trying to instill that into our kids and help them understand the importance of walking into marriage without the baggage and the U-Haul that creates. But let me tell you, if that's not the case for you, that does not need to be of prime concern. You're going to deal with baggage in that area that maybe other people won't, and it's part and parcel to the process, but God is forgiving. He is gracious. My wife and I have I hope, a great marriage. She can probably tell you better than I, because I married up, so she can let you know the status most days. But that is something that God has been so gracious in our marriage to deal with, and we were hopefully a godly couple. So ladies, guys, if that's not necessarily true of you, today's a new day, and from this point forward, you're walking new in the Lord, and you strive from this point forward to walk with God, and specifically in that area. So again, it's not, it's wonderful, it's icing, okay? It's not the cake. So just keep that in perspective, all right? So we see that this is a pretty neat gal so far. So as Eleazar literally is finishing up his prayer, he hadn't even said amen yet, here comes this gal, and she apparently is doing what the rest of the women in the village would have been doing, which is taking care of their families, okay? 17, here's the first words we see now Rebecca speak. Somebody pick up there. All right, so she takes care of him, okay, and watch this, keep going.
When she had finished giving him a drink, she said, I will draw the water for your camels also until they have finished drinking.
Now, he didn't ask for this, right? He wanted this in his prayer, and he asked God, he said, I need some water. But that's where he ended it. He didn't say feed or water my camels as well. He just said, I need to drink, okay? She takes responsibility for that and then recognizes you have a whole slew of camels, however many, we don't know, but she waters them as well, okay? Verse 19, until when? End of verse 19. Finished drinking, right? So, again, I have no idea how long this took, but a while, right? So she takes care of all of this, okay? A complete, again, complete stranger to her, okay? So just fascinating. She quickly emptied, in verse 20, her jar into the trough, ran back to the well to draw, and she drew for all his camels. Now, 21, watch what Eleazar is doing.
The man gazed at her in silence to learn whether the Lord had prospered his journey or not.
Okay, so he's not stalking her. This isn't like Creep-O-Matic. What is he doing? Praying, probably. To see if the Lord had made his journey successful or not. So there's certainly some spiritual side to this. He's just watching, right? He's putting himself in a place where he can watch a godly woman in her natural environment be godly, right? He's just there, okay? Principle for today. How would you apply that today, guys, gals? In a dating type relationship or environment. Okay. Dave, Casey, how did you guys bump shoulders with your wife and rub shoulders and figure out who they were before you met them? What environments did you put yourself in to be able to observe their character?
Well, I first noticed Tina was at a missionary, local missionary for CMDA, Christian Medical Dental. I just saw her working.
Servant first, huh? Cool.
Yeah, for me, it was a college setting, so I had a lot of mutual friends. So I got to see her interact with her friends as well as my friends. So seeing her character and that was pretty awesome. Hmm. Pretty incredible. And as well as kind of getting to ask about her reputation as well, not in a stalking way, but to hear her friends' opinions of her was also really cool.
That's huge, right? Jacob, Pete, anything you guys would add?
For me, when we went to the island of Tonga, where we're from, and girls are not really allowed to wear jeans or pants, and so my wife being from America, they were just, you know, they just kind of let her slide because it's not her culture. And so I remember the first day she came out and she wore a sarong over her jeans, and that was kind of like the utmost respect. And I was like, okay, all right.
Wow, that's cool.
And my mom kind of like,
pay attention.
Because of her doing that, a lot of people in the village were like, she's trying to adapt to us. So that was pretty cool.
That's neat.
I got to see my girl all the way through high school, so it's kind of weird.
Are you guys high school sweethearts?
Yes and no. We were homeschooled, so we didn't date until a year after college.
Thanks.
But otherwise, yeah.
Cool. Right on.
So yeah, we did like the worship team together, and we did student government together, and same church and family.
helps, right?
Figure all that out.
Uh-huh. Cool. Who else is married that would speak into this? You're getting some good thoughts, right? The principle is, where do you go to spend time, right, and learn to observe your potential future spouse in an environment where you're going to see the qualities that you want in marriage exalted, right? Service, hospitality, caring about others, not self-centered, right? Some environments are conducive to that, others are not, right? So where you begin to look for the spouse is important, right? And there's certain environments, you know, that are better than that than others, right? Which is funny that this is all at the well, but we won't get into those bad jokes. So anyway, so that's not what we hope our 7 o'clock service would turn into. However, in all honesty, put a whole bunch of godly people in a room that love Jesus and shake it up like that. I'm all right with that. Like they're gonna either go do it at a bar or they're gonna go do it, you know. Why not do it here? Why not find other godly people that are serving the Lord and go, you know what? I think that guy's, I like what I see in him. That gal, that's impressive. I wanna spend more time. What life group is that guy in, by the way? Oh, look, I'm gonna sign up for that life. I'm all right with that. That's, I mean, there's times that, you know, that's appropriate. So anyway, that was his heart. Eleazar was like, man, where can I see this gal's qualities when push comes to shove, right? She's tired. She's been working all day, and now she's got to feed her family. I don't want to feed a stranger and his camels. And man, what a pain in the rear, right? But here she is. So he's watching her and gazing and saying, man, I think God may be in this. This may be the gal that Abraham was praying for. So what a tough job, by the way. What if you blew this? Hey, Abraham! Like, man, what are you talking about, right? She's a snotty-nosed brat or whatever. And so a lot of pressure, right? So he takes this with a deep sense of conviction, okay? Came about, verse 22, when the camels had finished drinking, the man took a gold ring weighing half a shekel and two bracelets for her wrists weighing 10 shekels in gold and said, whose daughter are you? Please tell me, is there room for us in the lodge for your father's house? So he's basically saying, here's my checkbook, right? Here's my wallet. There's money in it, right? I am not some goofball. I'm legit. Here are some bracelets and some stuff to demonstrate that I'm from some pretty significant heritage. Whose daughter are you? Please tell me, is there room for us to lodge in your father's house? Two really important things to note. When you asked who somebody is, you always asked, where are you from and who is your father? That was in Israel, that is it, right? Ronan, our guide, his name is Ronan Ben Moshe. Ben Moshe means son of Moses. Ronan, son of Moses. That's not his actual last name. It's kind of a funny story. When his dad came into Israel after the occupation and he got a new job, he was in teaching, and then he became a farmer because they had to replant this area because it had been destroyed. They asked him who he was, and he said, I'm so-and-so, and my dad is Moses, right? His father's name was Moses, so that was his new last name. Whatever, son of Moses, Ben Moshe. So fascinating, but that's a really important deal. That is your heritage in Israel is of utmost importance. Like, my name is Mike, son of Dan, right? That's who I am. That is my identity. So he asked, who are you? Whose daughter are you? Who is your dad? And do you have room in your house for me? Can you be even more hospitable than you already have? Okay? And he says, I am the daughter of Bethuel, the son of Milcah, whom she bore to Nahor. Now, Eleazar certainly would have known about Abraham's family. There are lights and sirens going off in his head right now in a good way, right? Oh, Nahor, that's your brother. That's Abraham, my master's brother, and you're his daughter. So again, we're getting to this whole brother-sister thing again, but your family, okay? In this day and age, this is a good thing, okay? So again, y'all figure that out later about family trees and how many branches there are, but God's cool with it, so I'm cool with it for the time being. So they're good. In verse 25, here is her answer. All right, so basically, we've got places for you to sleep. We've got places for your camels to sleep. Come on, okay? Man bowed low to the ground, worship God. Verse 27, blessed be the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who has not forsaken his loving kindness and his truth toward his master. As for me, the Lord has guided me in my way to the house of my master's brothers. So he gets it, right? Thank God. Thank God that God's taking care of Abraham, and thank God that he's guiding me. So again, just in his mind's eye, Eliezer is concerned about his master, God, neat deal, okay? 28, the girl ran and told her mother's household about these things. Rebekah had a brother whose name was Laban. Okay, circle that name. He'll be important later. This is Jacob and Laban, okay? Ran outside to meet the man at the spring. Came about verse 30, when he saw the ring and the bracelets on her sister's wrist, and when they had heard the words of Rebekah, his sister, saying, "This is what the man said to me," he went to the man. Behold, he was standing at the spring with his camels. 31, Laban now says, "Come in, blessed of the Lord, you who stand outside, since I have prepared the house and a place for your camels." So we see Laban offering hospitality as well. Man, verse 32, brings him in. Laban unloads his camels, and then they're going to eat a meal. Okay, in 33 and following, they put out this meal, and Eliezer in 33 says, "Listen, I'm not taking a bite until I tell you why I'm here." Okay, so in verse 34 and following, he's going to share the entire story of his journey that Abraham asked him to go on, all of his family history, how he got here, what happened with he and Rebekah, and we won't read it all because that's exactly what he shares. But he starts in and says, "Listen, I am Abraham's servant. God has blessed my master," verse 35. "He's loaded. He's got flocks and herds and gold and servants and camels and donkeys. Sarah's master's wife bore a son," verse 36. "His name's Isaac. This is this kid. So this is why I'm here." So he reiterates his entire background to Laban, Rebekah's brother, to Bethuel, or Nahor, his dad, Bethuel, this other one of the characters in there, and then all of, like, they're at the family dinner table, and he's just talking, and here's why I'm here, all the way through to verse 49, okay? He shares the whole story that we just heard, okay? So, here's what happened with Rebekah, here's how I met her, here's what she did at the well, man, it was awesome. Verse 50, this is the reply from the family. Okay, so they clearly see, holy cow, like this is a divine thing. This is from the Lord. Okay, you get the idea that these guys understand who God is. So as Eliezer is talking about God, they're like, yeah, we know that God. And clearly what's happened here is from God. So verse 51, I mean, this is a pretty short decision-making process.
"Behold, Rebekah is before you. Take her and go, and let her be the wife of your master's son, as the Lord has spoken."
Dang, like, "Hey, Rebekah, can I have a vote? Can I have some say-so over here?" Like, she's sitting at the table with everybody else like, okay, I guess I'm going to Canaan. Like, that was fun, right? Interesting process, right? But this is brother and dad and family speaking on behalf of their daughter saying, man, this is clearly from God. Let's go, okay? So, came about verse 52, when Abraham's servant heard these words, he bowed himself to the ground before the Lord. He brings now silver and gold and ornaments to give to Rebekah. Also gave precious things to her brother and her mother. Okay. Then the men who were with him ate and drank, and they spent the night. They arose in the morning, and he said, "Send me away to my master." Okay, so deal's done. We got Rebekah. Woohoo! God's in this thing. And they answer him, verse 55. They said, "Eliezer wants to go," but Laban and Bethuel say, "No, no, no, do this." 55. So what's their answer? She can go, but 10 days at home first, okay? If you're Eliezer, what are you thinking right now? What are you eager to go do? Get home, right? I want to show Abraham who this gal is. I don't want to delay the journey. That's exactly what he says, okay? 56, "Do not delay me. Since the Lord has prospered my way, send me away that I may go to my master." Now, if you're Rebekah, what would you guess you're wanting to do right now? Leave immediately or stay 10 days? Stay 10 days. Hug mom, say goodbye, go see your friends, go have tea, right? You wanna leave properly. Like, this happened last night. You've spent the night. Now it's the morning, and Eliezer is, like, saddling up his camels. You're like, whoa, buddy, calm down. Like, this just happened 12 hours ago, right? It's breakfast. This happened at dinner. Can I at least say goodbye to my family? Watch this, okay? 57, "Now brother and dad do not answer. We will call the girl and consult her wishes. Okay, now this is a big deal. So she's now going to speak, and we're going to see again this gal's character, 58. Raven, read that.
And they called Rebecca and said to her, "Will you go with this man?" She said, "I will go."
Come on, right now. Let's go. Finish saddling the donkeys, or the camels. I'm ready to go. So those are the words that we hear from Rebecca in this piece of the story, right? They consult her and say, "Are you ready to go now? Because this guy wants to go now." And she says, "Bring it. Let's go." So again, a ton of respect for this gal, right? She's a neat, neat woman with a sense of, man, God's leading in her life. She knows where God's taking her. She's waited for this day, right? As a young girl, she's hoped to get married. Probably didn't see it going down this way, but who knows? But here it is, and she seizes the opportunity, okay? They sent Rebecca away with her nurse. Okay, this would have been the nurse that literally from birth was with Rebecca. They send her away with her as well to go. They send her with gifts and such. Verse 60, they blessed Rebecca and said to her, "May you, our sister, become thousands of 10,000s, and may your descendants possess the gate of those who hate them." So may you be blessed, and may you be abundant even amongst your enemies. Okay, Rebecca arose with her maids, mounted the camels, and followed the man. So she and the servant took Rebecca and departed. Okay, so cool story. So now they are heading back home. Now flash to what's going on back at home. What's happening now with Isaac? Where is he? Verse 62. Did I say 62? Sorry. Keep going, Jane. Sorry.
Now Isaac had come from Beer Lahai Roy, for he was living in the Negev.
Okay, so wherever that place is, this is the same place that when Hagar left town to go to Egypt, she was on her way. This is the place where the angel of the Lord met her, okay? This is the dirty south, okay? If you took Beersheba and went probably 40 miles southwest in the middle of the Negev. This is as far south as any of the patriarchs go. I mean, it is way out there. Okay, so you talk about Bedouin living in the desert. That's home base right now. So they're in, he'd come from Beer Hath, whatever that place is called. And again, they're still living in the Negev. So desert dwelling people. And watch what he's doing in verse 63. What do you think he's meditating about? What would you guess? Oh, dear God, please let Eleazar, right? He is begging God at this point. He gets no say-so, right? He's scanning the horizon, wondering if she's coming, and praying like crazy that God would grant the wish of his father and his wish as well. And look what happens. What a crazy deal. Who's that guy? That's your husband. Like, okay. So, and he says, "He is my master." Okay, watch what she does. Verse 65.
So she took her veil and covered herself.
What does that mean? Girls, what does that imply? What is she doing? Why would she cover herself?
Purity.
Modesty. Respect, right? So she is being respectful to the culture. She's being respectful to this man who's never met her. She's being modest, right? So just a cool picture, again, of this woman's character. Neat, neat gal, okay? And that is what continues to get exalted in this chapter is her character, right? Who she is. And I love that. So guys, remember that. 10 years into marriage, 15 years into marriage, the type of gal that you're going to want to marry, you're going to want to marry a gal that has solid character, okay? And vice versa, right? Ladies, that's what you want to find in a guy as well. Character is what matters in marriage. Looks and all those things, man, it all changes. You're never going to look as good as you do on your wedding day. It all goes downhill from there, all of us, right? Kids and life and wrinkles and, my kids the other day are like, "Daddy, where are all those lines on your forehead?" I'm like, thanks a lot, right? But that's reality. I'm getting old. And if my wife married me for my hotness, then good Lord, God help her, right? So wasn't that way to begin with, and it certainly ain't now 15 years later. So that's it's neat to see that that's what gets exalted. Okay, and we don't know much about, again, how Isaac looks either, but she is respectful. So verse 66, again, you can just imagine what this scene looked like. The servant told Isaac all the things that he had done. So you imagine that this whole conversation gets repeated with Rebecca standing here. Here's how I met her. Here's how it went down. Here's how many camels she watered. Then I met Laban and Bethuel. And here's the conversation that happened at dinner. And here was her crazy response of, no, let's not wait 10 days. We're going to go now. I mean, you can, and Isaac is just like hanging on every word, listening to the story and hearing about her character. And in verse 67, Isaac brought her into her mother Sarah's tent, and he took Rebekah, and she became his wife, and he loved her. Thus, Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. So he takes his wife into his parents' home, which would have been, that's what he had, right? And they become husband and wife. They do exactly what you think. They just became husband and wife right there, okay? So that is a Jewish wedding. Bam! Okay, woo! So anyway, so that's it. And now 25 can come. Abraham can die in peace. We now have a wife for Isaac, and his story is now going to fade into the, he's going to walk off into the sunset, or ride off into the sunset, and now Isaac is going to be the new patriarch on the scene. He is the next promise, okay? So, cool story. So just, guys, that's a fun chapter, gals as well, just to tuck away. Lots of great nuggets on there on dating and relationships, and just a great place to just to see character exalted over all other things in terms of the type of spouse that we're looking for. All right? Questions on that? Yeah, Mo.
Just a comment, just so we know. And we just can't say there's 10 camels. That's a lot of water.
Was it 250 gallons potentially? Mm-hmm. It, you know, divided by three, how many trips is that? Holy cow, over 80? Son, that's plus him. So that's a lot of trips to the well. So when we go to Beersheba, which is where their home base is, you'll get to drop one in and put, and you're like, good Lord. Like, we had to stop midway and switch people pulling up the bucket for one, right? Because your arms are just on fire. So, hard work. These gals were legit, okay? So, tough, tough women, okay? So, again, Isaac's about 40. So, he takes his wife at 40 years old, and now his dad's going to die. So, 25-1, kind of an interesting insertion into our story. So read that.
Abraham took another wife whose name was...
Yeah. So chronologically, it looks like this fits in after Sarah's death. That would be real nice theologically. I don't think that's the case. Most of the commentators say based on who she is, Abraham probably acquired her earlier while Sarah was alive. She has, in verse 2, Zimron, Jokshan, Medan. I think she has like six kids total with Abraham, okay? So, again, in this day and age, this wasn't about multiple wives. It's a very different meaning. So God allows it for a season that has never been his heart. But, you know, if you got the father of a nation propagating a world, for whatever reason, this is acceptable during this time. Okay, so whether or not it fits here, it may, but some of the commentators that I've read in respect say, it was probably, this wife probably came while Sarah was alive, so chronologically, this may not fit right here. So we're just talking about family and the death, and he's reviewing that. So we've got Sarah, and now we've got this other wife, okay? So Isaac and Ishmael, obviously, two of the sons that we know, and then we have six more over here, okay? Verse 4, the sons of Midian, we get a list of those. Verse 5, notice how the doling out of the inheritance goes. Okay, why is that significant? Who is the firstborn son? Ishmael. Who was treated as the firstborn son? Isaac. Who is the chosen son of God? Isaac. Okay, Abraham sees that. He knows that. God told him that. He gives everything to Isaac. To the sons of his concubines, verse 6, Abraham gave gifts while he was still living, sent them away eastward. Okay, these are the years that Abraham's life, he lived 175 years. So he blesses his other kids. It's not that he leaves them empty-handed, but the double portion and the significant blessing all goes to Isaac. Okay, so he is the chosen line. Okay, so again, interesting to see. Okay, verse 8, Abraham breathed his last, died at a ripe old age, an old man satisfied with life, and he was gathered to his people. Okay, gathered to his people is a A euphemism for death in the Old Testament, you get the idea of, man, he's going home, okay? So gathered to his people, ripe old age, happy life, and notice where he dies or where he is buried. Verse 9. Who else is in that cave? Sarah. So he dies with his wife. And who buries him? Isaac and Ishmael. When's the last time those guys have seen each other? You know, it's funny what funerals do and weddings do, right? They bring family together in a weird way. So, you know, dad died. It's like, okay, you know, Ishmael, come back from, you know, the Arabah, right, down south underneath the Dead Sea where you're living. Let's bury dad back into the land. Okay, let's make our peace. And you get the idea that, you know, he comes back and they have a cordial relationship, right? Not buddies, but they're brothers, half-brothers at least, right? And they're good, okay? So he's buried with his wife, Sarah, exactly where he wants to be, right? The one piece of land that he owns, he's got a well in Beersheba, and he's got a cave that he bought from the sons of Heath, the Hittites, called Machpelah, and he's buried in the land, right? In the heart of the promised land, okay? So pretty cool picture. And that's Abraham's life, right? 8 tests. Final in chapter 22, ended all with getting a wife for his son Isaac, and now he can lay his head down. Okay, now he was promised land, seed, and blessing, right? At this point, how much land does he have? Very little, right? He's in the promised land, so he's in the right place, but boy, he doesn't own it all, nor does his family. How much seed does he have? He's got a kid, and that kid's got a wife, so man, not a lot, but we're off to a good start, and he's got a few others from Ketua, this other wife, and what have you. But he's got a son that's got the promise and a wife that's godly, so we're off to a good start. How about blessing? How are we doing there? Not too shabby, right? God has blessed him. He's got stuff. God is taking care of him. So he rests his head with the promise of God not yet fulfilled in his life, but not in the sense that God has somehow dropped the ball, right? He knows that that promise will not continue in his son. And that's the big trick here. Will God's promise that he gave to Abraham continue in Isaac, or does it die now that the death of the guy who was promised to is dead? Okay, now that life is over. Okay? So, yes, ma'am.
Would it be normal at time to send your children away?
The non-firstborn, yeah, when there's strife, that seems to be part and parcel to the process. But like Isaac and wanting to keep him there in the land, that would have been normative for them to stay. But normative, like even in up to Jesus's day, the idea was you built your home onto your father's home. And that's how it grew. So you know, your house was separated by a wall to your parents' room that was separated by a wall to your great grandparents' room. And that's how communities, it's just one huge giant family. So I think this may be a little bit unique in the fact that there was so much strife that they had to do that. But community stayed pretty tight together in Israel. So, yeah. Okay. 12 and following, we get the descendants of Ishmael, okay? So this is his story, and again, God said he's going to be blessed, and he's blessed. So this kid's got a bunch of kids. He's blessed. Verse 17, Ishmael's going to die. These are the years of his life. Ishmael, 137 years old, so same as his mother Sarah, lives 137 years, breathes his last, and he dies. He is gathered to his people. They settled, and verse 18, from the Havilah to Shur, which is east of Egypt, as one goes toward Assyria. Okay, so again, south of the Negev, down in the hard regions. And my Bible says he settled in defiance of all his relatives. Anybody have a different reading of that in end of verse 18? Better translation is he lived east of his family, okay? So you get that word picture. In hostility, I mean, there was certainly tension, and that is true, but that wordplay of east is very strong here, okay, as my Bible commentator here in my study Bible notes, Ryrie, okay? So still tension, even though they got to bury dad together, okay? Now, 25:19, we're going to see now the story of Isaac, okay? Now, he does not get a ton of press in terms of the patriarchs, in terms of the amount of text he gets, but he's important nonetheless, okay? So, 19, let's now start our second patriarch. These are the records of Isaac, Abraham's son, as he became the father of Isaac. Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah. There you go, verse 20, there's your chronological anchor. 21, notice what is true of this son and wife as well. Read that.
Isaac was
So just like Sarah, we've got another barren patriarch, right? Isn't that just like God? Let's pick the next mother of the nation and let's let her be barren too. So Isaac has to pray. God answers, opens up her womb, and they conceive children. Okay, now we're going to see who is in her belly right now. 23, she realizes in 22 that there's a struggle happening in her stomach, and she's like, what the heck is going on, Lord? And this is what God's answer is, verse 23. Okay, so she says, Lord, there's like, man, they're fighting down there. I don't know what's going on. What's going on? And God says, there are two nations in your stomach, in your belly, in your womb, okay? They aren't just kids. They're going to represent nations, right? Two peoples shall be separated from your body, and one people shall be stronger than the other. The older shall serve the younger. Is that normative? No. Who would normally get the blessing? The firstborn, right? So God says, from the get-go, before these kids have done anything, before they're even out of the womb, I have already predetermined that the older will be a servant to the younger. Okay, now back up for a second. Theme of Genesis is what? Sovereign election. Now you can make an argument that the reason that God chose, had to choose Isaac and not Ishmael would be why? Why would God be forced to pick Isaac? Why would Ishmael potentially be a bad candidate? Who did she come from? Hagar, right? From Egypt. We can't have the woman or the lineage of a nation come from the patriarch of this family who sleeps with his prostitute, his concubine, and now fathers a nation. So clearly I can't choose Ishmael, so God has to choose Isaac. There could be an argument made for that. What would be a better argument of sovereign election? How about two kids in the womb who have done nothing, good or bad, and God says, I'm choosing this one, I am not choosing that one. Is that a pretty good argument for sovereign election? They do nothing, they have done nothing good or bad, they haven't deserved a blessing or not deserved a blessing. God says to Rebekah, while these kids are in your womb, I have already chosen one son over the other. Okay, that, my friends, is sovereign election. Why did God do it that way? I have no idea, but God said, I'm picking Jacob, and I am going to pass over Esau. Now, Esau's going to get blessed. He's going to have a ton of kids. He's going to get blessed just like Ishmael did. However, he is not the chosen son, okay? So, before they're even out of the womb, we see this picture of sovereign election coming to the forefront, okay? Malachi chapter 1 has some pretty strong words about this as well. Yeah, Layla. Yeah. 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 It's going to be the first one that comes out. You got it. You got it. So it's a funny, even in their birth, right? It's a funny story to see how they come out. Okay. Turn real quick to Malachi chapter 1. I just want to show you fascinating commentary on Malachi regarding these two kids, right? So we know Jacob and Esau are the two kids that are in Rebekah's stomach, right? Malachi 1, first verse, the oracle of the word of the Lord to Israel through Malachi. So Malachi is a prophet at the end of Israel's days, okay? Verse 2, I have loved you, says the Lord, but you say, how have you loved us? Was not Esau Jacob's brother, declares the Lord, yet I have loved Jacob. So there's this back and forth between God and this people. They say they've loved God, and God says, basically, no, you haven't. You've been chumps. How have you loved us is their answer. And then he says in verse 2, I have loved Jacob, which is Israel, right? But I have, verse 3, what's the word used for how he feels about Esau? Hated. That's a strong word, right? What does that mean? I have loved Jacob and hated Esau. Does God mean hate in the way that we hear the word hate? What's the context there? What does that mean? Preference is certainly a piece of it, yeah. Rachel? Yeah, it's the idea of chosen, not chosen. It's I chose, I have, my covenantal love, my hesed is on Jacob. I have chosen this kid, And Esau I have hated or not chosen. But this isn't like a animosity or hatred in the sense that we would think of it towards Esau. But God is literally saying, from the womb, I have picked one and I have passed over the other. Okay, so I have loved Jacob and hated Esau. I have favored one over the other. Does God have the right to do that? Yeah, I mean, it's hard. But because of God's choice, he wants to make sure that he shows us that, man, his way of thinking or his line or his choosing isn't based on anything that we do. It's based on his choosing, which is motivated by love. So he doesn't hate Esau. And we see by his actions that he blesses him and takes care of him. He doesn't hate him, but he didn't choose him. Okay, so Malachi gives us a little bit there on these two kids. Okay, again, before they even come out of the womb. Now, you're going to see a lot of evidence why both these kids are chumps, to be honest with you. Esau is a chump in his own way. Jacob is not like this bright, shining light of godliness by any stretch of the imagination. So in their actions that follow, it's pretty clear that God wasn't like, oh, I've got a great kid and a terrible kid. I'll choose you, right? A student.
So you mean chosen by he's not one of the elect?
Correct.
He doesn't believe in God.
Yeah. We're going to see that fleshed out in his life for sure. So yeah, and that's part of the argument here is elect, not elect. We see that as well in Romans 9. Both these kids are going to get brought up again in God's choosing of sovereign election in terms of salvation. So they're going to be examples in other places as well. So yep. Okay, so let's watch these two kids get born. 24, back to Genesis. When her days were delivered, were fulfilled, behold, there were two twins in her womb. Now the first came forth red, all over like a hairy garment, and they named him Esau. Okay, so apparently this kid from birth is just crazy hairy, okay? And they name him Esau, which means red, okay? So he's got red hair on his arms. I mean, this guy, you'll see later on, he is Darwin's favorite example of evolution. This kid is hairy, okay? Afterward, verse 26, his brother went forth, his hand holding Esau's heel, so he was named Jacob. Now, what does Jacob mean, by the way? Heel catcher, okay? So his brother Esau comes out first with Jacob's hand on his heel, okay? It means heel catcher, supplanter, trickster, okay? Jacob is going to get, he's going to have to live up to his namesake. So just remember that. His name means trickster. This is practical joker. This is, I'm going to one-up you. I'm always a step ahead of you in the game. I'm always outthinking you. That's Jacob. He's shrewd. He's cunning. And he's looking out for himself, okay? So that's going to be his life, okay? And then you've got Esau, who's just like, man, think about the guy in camo that lives in the woods, right? That big hairy beard. Like, that's Esau. He's just a man's man and smells, and like, that's Esau, okay? These guys couldn't be more opposite, okay? So his name was Jacob, and Isaac was 60 years old when she gave birth to them, okay? So 20 years now into Isaac's marriage, they have kids, okay? 27, let's kind of fast forward through these guys' history. We don't get a ton on their upbringing, but we get to kind of their later on years. Pick up at 27. Okay, you're seeing the distinction in these two kids' life. So here you got like outdoorsman, Bear Grylls, right? Esau that likes to hunt and fish and cuss and dip, and right? That's Esau, okay? And then you got Jacob, who's doing what? He's got on his apron, right? He's cooking with mom in the house. He's kind of a mama's boy, homebody, right? I'm being a little bit facetious, but you don't want any part of that life, right? So we got a hunter, and we got a guy that's just content being in the home. He's a peaceful man. A bit of a mama's boy and a guy that's probably a little bit too much on the, you know, I'm going to eat raw flesh side of things, okay? So that's the kids. 28, keep going.
Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game, but Rebekah loved Jacob.
So who does Isaac favor? Esau. Who does God favor? Jacob. Now, does Isaac know that?
Yeah.
Yeah, he knows that, right? So this wasn't a surprise that God had picked Esau. Now, I don't know about you guys. Those of you that have kids, you'll learn quickly that there are kids that have tendencies, like you have tendencies, and it's a lot easier to interact with them because they like to do the same things that you like to do, right? So as a dad, I have a kid that loves to be in the garage, right? We changed my oil the other day. She's under the truck with me, right? She thinks that's the coolest thing ever. My other kids are like, what are you doing? Like, those are the things that I like to do. So it's much easier to naturally connect with her because our natural activities overlap. I don't love her more, but I have to make much less effort to connect with her because if I'm out working in the garage or messing around in the yard, she wants to be out there with me doing stuff. That's just her personality. The other kids are not that way. Now, I have to make an extra concerted effort to connect with them. I've got one kid that unless you like intentionally choose to interact with her, she'll go sit in a room and hang out by herself all day and is totally content with that, right? She's an introvert and she loves me, but she's totally content to not be around me or anyone else, right? You have to kind of call her out of that at times to interact with her, and she needs that alone time, which is good for her. But they're just different. So Jacob being a, Isaac probably being more wired like Esau finds a lot more natural connectivity to that. The guy wants to be outside, he wants to hunt, he wants to fish, he wants to, you know, cuss and dip. And that's what Isaac wants to do. So great. And Jacob wants to go hang out with mama and cook dinner. That's fine. Go do that. Okay? But he does not have that connection, so he favors him naturally. The problem is, God said, no, that's not the way the blessing is going to go down. Now, Isaac doesn't so much like that. Okay? So he's going to have an issue with that. Okay? So 29, let's see how the story kind of goes. Edom, okay, which is means red. Okay, Esau, Edom, all means red. So Esau is the father of the Edomites. Okay, so we're going to see tons of issues with the Edomites all throughout Israel's history. So Moab and Edom to the east of the Jordan River, the mountains of Moab. Okay, we're going to see kind of that region as well. So Edom, the Edomites, are going to be his lineage. Okay, so Esau comes in. He's been hunting all day. He's hungry. And Jacob's been cooking stew. So give me some food. Jacob's answer, 31. I'm hungry, and he says, great, sell me your birthright. Now, that's like saying, I'm hungry, I'll trade you this bowl of stew for your mansion, or like everything that you have, right? And Esau says, 32.
Esau said, I'm about to die, so what use is the birthright to me?
Great, take it, I'm hungry, right? What do you see in Esau? Like, what type of guy is he? He's a now, I'm hungry, fleshly. Like, what does my birthright or my future have to do with now? I want satisfaction now. Take my birthright. So he sells it to him, right? So they exchange birthrights. Verse 33, Jacob said, first swear to me. So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. Now, this can be done in this culture, right? You can sell your birthright. There are stories of that in this time with other cultures around them that would have done that. The problem is, what is Jacob doing? What has God already said is going to happen? You're the guy. You're the guy that's going to get the blessing. Now, why would Jacob feel like he's not? Read into this for me a little bit. Because his father favors his brother, right? So he's grown up his whole life seeing something that's very different than what God has said is true. I think so. They would have known that. I mean, that when God speaks to you, right, you don't keep that private. They would have known that. But just, I think, throughout their lives, Jacob doesn't see that. So Esau is clearly the one favored by Isaac, okay? So it's an odd situation. So Jacob is being Jacob. He's being a trickster, okay? I have something that you need. I know that you're a man of the flesh, okay? You cannot think without your belly, so sell me your birthright and I'll give you the stew. So he's completely manipulating the situation to get exactly what he wants. And he does. Esau doesn't care about his birthright. He's just, again, a fleshly now type of guy. And then he's going to have the audacity to get mad at Jacob for buying his birthright later in life and try to kill him. Okay, so These guys are going to have an interesting relationship as brothers. Okay, not healthy.
Do we know about how old they are?
What did it say? Jacob is, or Isaac was 60. So these guys are in their 20s, I think, if not maybe a little bit later than that. So at least that old. So these are grown men, right, that are on in life. Okay. So verse 34, unfortunately, the guy doesn't even get a steak out of it. I mean, this is his meal. Read 34. Right, so like he doesn't even get a good meal out of it. Lentil stew, that doesn't sound good at all in bread. I mean, I'm a carb guy, but I mean, come on, at least get me some cow. So birthright sold, there you go. And he despised his birthright. He thought very little of it, and that's the picture, okay? So you see how these kids were polar opposites. You can imagine there's tension in the home. Mom favors one, dad favors another. Birthrights are sold. Like, what are you learning about Isaac? Like, give me a, on the godly scale, where is he? I mean, read into this.
I feel like because he wanted to buy Esau's birthright, but possibly had already been told that he was the chosen son, there's not a lot of trust in God's word.
You kind of get that impression, right? That they're learning that maybe from dad, right? Neither one of these guys have a big... yeah, view of what God said. So, nor does Isaac, for that matter, because he's trying to manipulate it the other way. Like, God, I don't care what you said. I'm going to bless Esau. And you're clearly going to see that Isaac is going to make every attempt to bless Esau. Like, period. That is what's on Isaac's mind. So, you know, again, we get a patriarch, the father of the nation of Israel, who's not the most godly, bright, shining example. So, thank God God included these in Scripture. We'd be all in trouble. Yeah, see also chapter 26. We're going to see issues with Isaac that came directly from dad. So, yep. Do you have a thought, Jessica? So, yeah. So, scary, okay? So, parents, put these lenses on in chapter 26. Watch what Abraham passed on to Isaac, okay? 26:1. Watch what is continuing in the land, okay? There was a famine, different famine that was in the days of Abraham. So Isaac says, I'm going to go to Gerar, just like my daddy did. I'm heading out of here, and I'm on my way to Egypt. Okay, remember, Gerar is where Hagar was fleeing when she got booted out of the camp on her way to go to Egypt. Okay, so they're going west towards the Philistines and then south to them. Okay, look who shows up, verse 2. Okay, I will multiply your descendants, the stars of heaven. This is one of the first times we see recorded, at least, God's promise directly to Isaac. I promised your dad, I'm going to take care of you. There's a rebuke in here from God, and I infer that kind of back into Abraham. He's leaving to go to Egypt, and what does God say? No. Stay here. Okay, I want you here. You don't need to go to Egypt. I'm going to bless you. I'm going to take care of you. Dad did the same thing, and that's his knee-jerk reaction. Again, so like father, like son. Okay? He is blessed in that. He's commanded to stay. And in verse 6, Isaac lived in Gerar. So he was heading west, and he sets up shop in Gerar, which, again, is on, it's in the coastal plains, okay? So he is now, he's on the west-hand side. He's in the area of the Philistines, and that's who he's interacting with, okay? Abimelech, the guy that Abraham interacted with earlier, that guy named Abimelech, or the title of Abimelech, also lives there. So they're going to have an interaction, okay? Verse 7, when the men of the place asked about his wife, he said, she is my sister. For he was afraid to say my wife, thinking the men of the place might kill me on account of Rebekah, for she is beautiful. Like, how many times have we seen this now, right? Abraham had this happen to him twice, failed it twice, right? And we found out that wasn't probably the only two times in Scripture that had happened. That was normative for Abraham. So where does Isaac learn, in a pinch, lie to save your skin? Dad. Same situation. Isaac gets put in it, and he says, hey, Rebecca, you are my sister. You are not my wife. Are we clear? Good. Okay? So, we're going to see now for the third time how this story fleshes out. Okay? This is the second time with Abimelech. This is a new Abimelech. Okay? This is a new Mr. President, not the same guy from Abraham. Mm-hmm.
Because Sarah was Abraham's half-sister, right?
And she is too. So we still got an unbranched family tree. Is it cousin? Okay. I'm horrible at family trees. There's still a little bit too much not branching for me. But yes, okay. So they're kissing cousins. Whatever. I guess this is a little bit more on the on the gray scale. I guess it's moving towards more black and less white, because either way, it's not the right, so he's lying, but it's fascinating to me that he watched that in his home, right? He watched dad do this growing up, and son now thinks, man, you can trust God to a point, but when push comes to shove, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, do what you got to do to survive, okay? So it's an unfortunate situation, okay? Came about when he had been there a long time that Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked out through a window and saw, and behold, Isaac was caressing his wife, Rebekah. So here's Isaac making out with his sister, and he goes, whoa, time out. That ain't right. That is not brother-sister. That is husband-wife. So they're doing exactly what you think they're doing, okay? Verse 9, Abimelech comes to Isaac and says, hey, what the heck? Certainly, she is your wife. How then did you say she is my sister? And Isaac said to him, because I thought I might die on her account. So, sound familiar? Abimelech says, verse 10, what is this you have done to us? Our people might easily have lain with your wife, and you would have been, you would have brought guilt upon us. So again, the rebuke by the pagan to the Christian in the situation, right? Just an unfortunate situation.
Can you imagine how annoyed he is by now? Like, this has happened to him.
Yeah, well, Abimelech, this is not the same guy. This is probably his father or whatever that happened before, but he certainly knew of it. Exactly. Like, haven't we done this before? I thought my dad told me the story that happened with your dad, right? Like, that's not right. It's, on a serious note, it's super unfortunate, because here you have the guy in the story that's supposed to have the sense of morality that doesn't, and the guy that doesn't does, right? And he's rebuking the Christian for acting like a pagan from the pagan's mouth, right? Yeah, good question.
Especially if they're so concerned about
modesty and, well, it's through a window, so I assume it's in their home, and, you know, privacy is you're living in tents, right? So it's not like we have privacy today where you can go behind your door with thick walls and lock it, and, you know, that didn't exist. On a serious note, I was out riding with a buddy of mine last week, and we were talking about a situation. He is a non-believer, right, and doesn't know God from a hole in his head. Great guy, but just is not. He's got Christians all around his life, but he just has never, you just don't see a whole lot spiritually going on within him, but he's a really neat guy. And we got to talking about a mutual friend of ours who's a believer and just basically flushed his life, had an affair, had a long-standing affair with another woman. And it came out, right? And my buddy, who is a non-Christian, is calling out this guy's lack of morality. And I'm like, man, what a fascinating picture that you understand as a non-Christian, you have no, where do you get that from? What makes that wrong? But he says, man, that's wrong. You don't do that. And he's calling out this guy that is a very vocal Christian, talks about his faith all the time, and lo and behold, he's been sleeping with another woman for years. You're like, man. So it's such a sad picture when a non-Christian has to call the Christian to the carpet and say, how dare you? How would you live like that? Like, I know better, and I don't have a book or a God or that tells me to do all these things. I wouldn't do that with my wife, you know? And so it's unfortunate. So this is It's a pretty big slap in the face, right, to Isaac, okay? And it should be. He needs to feel the sting of that, okay? So Abimelech charges all his people, saying, he who touches this man or his wife shall surely be put to death, so leave them alone. God protects them in the situation. Okay, Isaac, if not for God, you don't know how the situation would have turned up, but God has to step in and save their bacon, okay? 12 and following, even in the midst of this, how is his life going? Read that. If you're a farmer, you like to hear that? You reap a hundredfold of what you sow? Yeah, that's called a good year, right? The man became rich, continued to grow richer until he became very wealthy. So just like dad, God blesses him. He has, verse 14, possessions, flocks, herds, a great household, and the Philistines envied him. Like, God is blessing his socks off, okay? So amazing even in the midst of this, okay? But had to be rebuked by a pagan, okay? Now, interesting situation here in verse 15. All the wells which his father's servants had dug, so Abraham's wells in the days of Abraham, the Philistines stopped up with earth, okay? Now, if that's not a stick it to you, like, we don't want you here, we're dumping dirt in your wells. Again, wells not easy to dig, and they just said, the heck with you, we don't like you, we're going to throw dirt in your wells, okay? So that's a pretty significant, like, e-break in your life when you don't have water anymore, okay? So Abimelech says in verse 16, go away from us. You are too powerful for us. So we can't live together anymore. This is like Lot and Abraham again, right? We're not buddies to begin with, but we kind of need to separate because there's tension, okay? Verse 17, Isaac does the right thing. He departs, okay? Verse 18, he digs another well, which had been dug in the days of his father Abraham. So if you know where wells are, you go redig the same ones. That's smart because there was water there to begin with. There's probably water there now. For the Philistines had stopped them up in the days of Abraham, end of verse 18, and he gave them the same names which his father had given them. Okay, so he redigs them, renames them, and he's claiming them again for himself. Again, idea of ownership and the land, and this is obviously significant. When Isaac's servants dug the well, and they found a well of water, you know, surprise, surprise, there is water in there, the herdsmen of Gerar quarreled with the herdsmen of Isaac, saying, the water is ours. Wait a second. You threw dirt in this well that my father dug. I came back, redug it, named it the same thing, and now that there's water in it, it's your well. Oh, I see. So you can see the frustration with Isaac, right? That he took this time, he dug the well, clearly was his dad's, clearly is his, and they say, no, it's ours, right? So they named it Esek because they contended with him. They dug another well in verse 21. They named it Sitna, okay? That means contention and quarreling are the two names of those wells. So not good names, right? So Isaac now has to flex again. Verse 22, moves away from there, digs another well. They did not quarrel over it, so he names it Rehoboth, okay? And which means, end of verse 22, at last the Lord has made room for us. We shall be fruitful in the land. I think Rehoboth means like plenty of room or something like that. Yeah, plenty of room, okay? So big tension over waters. They're trying to get him out of the land. They don't like him being here. And again, tension between Isaac and the non-Christians in the land. And he's finally finding some room. Okay, verse 23, he went up there to Beersheba. Okay, so again, living in the Negev, goes to the northern part of the land. And we'll kind of finish up here. Verse 24, watch what now God continues to say to Isaac. Okay, so you kind of see this cool picture of in the midst of Isaac's difficulty and frustration and having to flex with the non-Christian in the land and being accused of something that he clearly wasn't in the wrong with, but yet takes the high ground. God shows up and says, man, right call. I am your God. I will be with you. Do not fear. I will take care of you. So a long way from lying to Abimelech, we're seeing some progress in this guy's life, maybe some maturing. Okay, and Isaac's, again, is kind of a fast-forward story. But God promises to take care of him. So we're seeing the promise continue, the testing continue, the stories continue. But God is clearly with Isaac. Okay, 25, he builds an altar. He digs a well. He worships God. So we're like, all right, Isaac, well done. And now in 26 and following, we'll pick up on this tomorrow, Abimelech's going to try to make peace again with Isaac. Same type of deal with Abraham. They're going to make a covenant, and they're going to agree to live at peace with one another. Okay, and then 27 that we'll look at tomorrow, we're going to see one of the most unfortunate chapters in all of Genesis. Just, we'll see how the birthright ultimately gets played out and moving on into Jacob and Esau's life after that. All right? So we'll pick up there tomorrow. You guys have a great day.